Hello, full-bodied family. Thank you all so much for tuning into another episode of the Full-Bodied Crime Podcast. As always, my name's Kayla, and I have missed you guys so much. I apologize. I've been a little MIA. I've been super busy applying to schools and working and doing a little bit of traveling. And in the midst of all that, I got hit by the biggest seasonal allergy train ever. These almond blossom trees in California. Oh my gosh, I don't know if you guys, are from California or have driven through California, but we have these, pink trees, and, well, they're pink and white, they're almond blossoms, and I swear to you, they're gonna be the death of me. They make my allergies so bad, and in the area of California I live in, they're everywhere, so I've been dying, so I figured I'd spare you the extra nasally voice and wait until I got a little bit better, but I'm still dealing with some throat stuff and some nose stuff, so I apologize if I sound extra nasally today, but I missed you guys too much, so I was like, let me hop on here, and due to my recent absence for a little bit, I feel like I was gone for a long time. I'm not only bringing you this episode, but I'll also have another episode for you tomorrow. So within 24 hours, you're going to get two episodes. But let's give you what you came here for and get into today's episode. So as I mentioned actually during the last episode, I had a private investigator reach out to me about this case. And I'm so, so grateful they did because honestly, I've never heard about that or this whole situation. And that kind of makes no sense that it wasn't, more of a national news story, and it's kind of frustrating that I've never heard of this. I feel like the media is often so selective on what they share, and the fact that this wasn't something I was aware of, or anyone that I've talked to, they've never been aware of this case, so even when I Googled the name of the victim, I had to type in the entire name all the way down to the junior for anything to pop up. So it's time to get this case out there. I mean, I'm pretty sure not a lot of people in California know about it. Granted, it happened across the country, but you never know. Someone always knows something. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. On this episode, we're going to be discussing the disappearance of Patrick Kennedy Alford Jr. Patrick Alford was just 7 years old when he seemingly completely vanished into thin air. So Patrick was this adorable little African-American boy, and the reason I want to make his race very apparent in the beginning of the episode is because all too often we see this theme in the media. They report what they want to report, and unfortunately they often do not give nearly enough light to missing persons or missing children's cases when they're of African-American descent. I mean, I had to dig and dig and dig to find information on this case, which to me just confirms that this case was completely underreported, but unfortunately this is a running theme and it isn't something just specific to Patrick's case. So, like I mentioned, Patrick Kennedy Alford Jr. was this adorable little boy with this huge smile, and friends and family often referred to him as Little P, or Lil P. I'm probably butchering that. You know, someone the other day was, arguing with me because I swore 50 Cent. I'm like, his name's 50 Cent, the rapper. And they're like, no, it's 50 Cent. And I'm like, no, it's 50 Cent. And anyway, so I'm butchering Lil P. But anyway, friends and family would call him Lil P. Patrick was raised in Staten Island, New York, by his mother, Jennifer Rodriguez. Now, his father wasn't out of the picture, but his parents didn't live together, so Jennifer was somewhat of a single mother, and his dad lived about 40 minutes away in the Harlem, New York area. So Jennifer was just 22 years old at the time of Patrick's disappearance, so if he was 7, if I'm doing my math right, she had Patrick at around the age of 15 or 16, and then gave birth to his little sister Jaylene at around the age of 18. Now, we all know that there's usually inevitable hardships young parents face, but it's even more complex if you're having to fill the primary caregiver role, because since you had children at such a young age, it's hard for you to get an education, get a well-paying job, and childcare is so expensive that even people who do make more than minimum wage, I mean, they can hardly afford it. And in this case, there wasn't just one child, but two. So it would have even been more expensive to put her children in daycare so that she could have a job. So, I mean, it's obviously assuming that Jennifer experienced numerous hardships, and she did try to be the best mother she could be, but Per a Reddit article on this case, in December of 2009, Patrick's mom was suffering from depressive disorder, and she was also facing charges of theft. So at this point, the Administration of Children's Services went to step in and assess the situation, and eventually the children were taken on the basis of visually seeing drugs and child neglect. Now, numerous family members, including Patrick's father, aunts, cousins, I mean, seriously, a lot of close people to Patrick, they attempted to gain custody of the children once they were taken from their mother, but instead the court system placed both of them in foster care, which, to me, it makes me upset. I mean, in some sense, I understand that maybe some of the family members were unfit to take care of the children. I mean, I don't know, that's just my assumption. But the whole span of people, from the father, cousins, aunts, I mean, all of them can't be unfit to take care of the children. So, to me, this ruling makes no sense. But then again, I wasn't there. I don't know why this happened. And I like to think that the courts had some sort of justification over this, but I don't really know. I think most of us, even on a statistical level, can agree that the foster care system needs reform. So, from an outsider's perspective, I guess I just don't understand why the court wouldn't consider sending Patrick and Jaylene to live with their father or live with a family member versus foster care. So once entered into the foster care system, the children were then placed in the home of Labrada Moran. Now, Patrick and Jaylene's mother, Jennifer, later described the conditions of the foster home as, quote, less than an upgrade for Patrick. And when his mom went to visit him the following month, she said Patrick was showing severe signs of distress and making it very known to his mom how uncomfortable he was and how much he hated the Moran home. This is a direct quote from a Reddit article, but Jennifer said he was, quote, just acting crazy. He was crying, acting out, throwing a chair. He was like, no, I want to come home, mommy. I want to be with you. I want to be with you. Now, I want to add that prior to being entered into the foster care system, Patrick was diagnosed with ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and sometimes when people have ADHD, they don't necessarily know how to handle or appropriate their emotions, so I'm sure he was extremely emotional about not being with his mother and being in a completely new environment. Plus, who knows if Moran was patient and competent enough to take care of Patrick and make him feel comfortable in her home? And who really knows if she had ever been around someone with ADHD before? Granted, ADHD is very common, and often a lot of times you don't even know someone has it because there's very mild to severe cases. But for example, my boyfriend has ADHD, and sometimes I have to remind myself to just be patient. It's nothing against him, but occasionally his behaviors are expressed in a different way than what I'm used to. So sometimes I'm like, oh, this isn't something that he's doing out of, you know, anger or something different rooted in his brain. It's specifically the ADHD, which is why he can't focus on what I'm trying to tell him right now, or why he's extremely sensitive or emotional to this situation. I mean, you literally just have to learn to be patient and learn that these things are expressed in different ways. I mean, it's nothing against them, but who knows if Moran was, like I said, competent enough to deal with Patrick, who may have had anywhere from a mild to severe case of ADHD. To continue adding to the complexity of this case, there was a huge language barrier between the two because Labrada Moran only spoke a small amount of English, and she was primarily Spanish-speaking. So not only were Patrick and Jaylene ripped from the only lives they ever knew, taken from their mother, placed into foster care in a completely new home with a stranger in a completely new area of New York, but on top of that, they're also with someone who doesn't even fluently speak their same language. So Patrick was clearly miserable in this house, and his mother was doing everything in her power to get her children back. Jennifer also reports that Patrick had made numerous attempts to escape, and he told his mom that he was going to harm himself if he had to go back to Moran's home. So this is even more heartbreaking with this entire case. I mean, we have a psychiatric portion of the ER that I work in, and because we're the only hospital in my area with a contracted behavioral health center, and we're seeing a rapid, and I mean rapid, increase of children with suicidal ideation, which is it's horrible to see. I mean, mental health issues seem to be presenting themselves at a younger and younger age with younger and younger children year by year. So it's tragic that Patrick even had this idea in his head at just 7 years old and would even say something so heart-wrenching at such a young age. I think what's even worse, and this is a direct quote from a Reddit article, but it states, quote, "A judge ruled that Patrick was showing signs of emotional instability and ordered him to undergo psychiatric testing and treatment." Like, come on, judge. That's your solution. I mean, yes, I hope he gets the psychiatric help he needs, but for Christ's sakes, literally in a snap of a finger, this kid got ripped from everything he's ever known, the town he lived in. I mean, everything. His mom, and now he's living with someone who doesn't even speak his same language in a house that he's not comfortable in. And you think he needs mental health testing versus, I don't know, being with a family member or going into an environment that he's comfortable with? Like, I don't know. I feel like it's obvious to understand that Patrick is undergoing an extremely traumatic situation, and I think they should have definitely explored options of him living with family or even a foster parent who spoke the same language that could communicate with him. It's just insane to me how people don't understand to what extent these childhood traumas can cause, like, how significant of hardships they can cause later in life, yet we routinely see corruption in the foster care system and childhood trauma year after year, and there's absolutely no reform. It just makes no sense to me. And really quickly, thank you to all the foster care parents who do put in the time and effort to care and try to make the best life for the children that they intake, because you're making a huge change in their lives and your position is more important than you'll ever know. But anyways, basically at this point in time, it's completely obvious how miserable Patrick is, but he still is a great kid with a great heart and is trying to please Labrada Moran when he is staying in her home. So, on January 22nd, 2010, Patrick was doing just that. He was doing chores for Labrada Moran in her Brooklyn apartment and was trying to help her around the house that day. And one of the chores that he had to do that night was take out the trash. And mind you, they lived in, you know, Brooklyn, New York, in an apartment complex, so the trash can wasn't just right next to the home. And in this specific complex, you had to walk down near the lobby to take the trash out. So even though Moran wasn't necessarily a caring foster parent, she also wasn't neglectful. So knowing that the dumpster was far away, about 11 stories down near the lobby, she escorted Patrick down the lobby to get rid of the trash. Everything is seeming normal and fine at this time. They put the trash into the dumpster, begin walking back to their apartment, but then something happens. And I think the worst thing about this entire case is that nobody knows what happened. Basically, the character of events is that Patrick and Labrada were walking back to their apartment from taking out the trash when Labrada received a phone call. She looked down at her phone to see who was calling and answered it. Within those small, literal seconds it took her to answer her phone, she flips around to look back at Patrick, and he's gone. Just like that. He isn't in the distance running. He isn't anywhere being pulled away by anyone. He is simply just gone. Almost like his body evaporated into thin air. Now, Patrick's long-standing history of running away and his threats of running away and all his attempts did make NYPD basically assume that this is exactly what happened. They assumed Labrada turned her head for a split second and Patrick saw this as his time to run, which isn't completely implausible. I mean, he had threatened it on numerous occasions, so perhaps if he saw this moment in time to escape his foster home, then he was going to take that opportunity to run as fast as he could away from Labrada. But my main issue with this claim is, if he ran away, where is Patrick now? Like, to me, that makes no sense. But before I get too far into any of my theories, another assumption is that Patrick's mom possibly kidnapped him because she had made comments on numerous occasions that she was going to get her children back. Now, this last theory is much more sinister. Could Patrick have been abducted by someone he didn't know? Did something much more evil happen to Patrick? Was he snatched away in plain sight during the walk back to the Moran apartment? Like, where is Patrick? Now, here are my questions and thoughts on all of these theories. Like I mentioned before, if Patrick ran away, where is he now? His mother and family members have no idea where Patrick is. They lived nowhere near his foster home, so he would basically have completely ran away without any plan in place and nowhere to go, no phone to call his mother. And then something had to have happened to him in order for him to be missing for all of these years. If he did hide in bushes, like, and take off like a lightning bolt from Moran, then what happened during his route trying to find his mother or somewhere he could be safe? Was he then kidnapped? Did he stumble across some, you know, rough terrain and maybe fall and hurt himself? I mean, to me, if he ran away, then something sinister or terrible happened to Patrick because, you know, children aren't like stray dogs. You don't see a child out wandering on the streets and offer them, you know, a new warm and cozy food-filled home. That doesn't happen with children. So as much as I would love to hope that Patrick is somewhere with a great family, enjoying every day of his life, there's just no way on a legal basis that, I mean, that's even possible. So on to theory number two of his mother kidnapping him. Why would she take one child and leave the daughter? To me, that makes no sense. Like, why would you only kidnap your son and leave your even younger daughter in the apartment and not also kidnap your daughter? Plus, it's not likely that she knew that at this specific hour, this 9 o'clock hour or time period, that Moran and Patrick were going to take the trash out. And even if they pre-planned like a specific time to exit the apartment so that his mother could complete this well-thought-out kidnapping, then Patrick would have made sure his sister was with him. And I don't think that his mother would be searching and searching and searching so extensively for her son if she was the one that had him in her care, or if, you know, even a family member kidnapped him. Now, lastly, this last theory that someone kidnapped him right then and there on his walk back to the apartment is also so confusing and hard for me to believe. I feel like abducting a child would have at least caused some sort of, like, feet shuffling or some noise that would have alerted Labrada that something was wrong. Now, I will say that I cannot find exact measurements of like how far Patrick and Labrada were from each other, but I do feel like if the entire incident was as quick as Labrada mentions, that she would have seen or noticed something. But it can also happen in an instant. I mean, I know that we know that from all these other cases, so who really knows, you know, if that theory is true or how far they were or how involved Labrada was in watching over Patrick at that exact moment in time. But you know, now that you've heard my opinion, let's get back to the facts of the case. So after Patrick seemingly vanished, investigators did presume that he ran away, but they wanted to make sure that they could cover all of their bases. So they had helicopters in the air looking for him, boats that were scouring nearby ponds and swamps, and, you know, they were also doing their ground searches as well. But there was absolutely no sign of Patrick. What I mean, it seems like he vanished into thin air. There's basically been no evidence in this case. On a judicial level, the case was handled, you know, somewhat abnormally because the courts told Jessica Rodriguez, Patrick's mom, that she needed to bring forth his son, and she is adamant, like, I do not have my son. If I had him, I would not be here. And I'm also sure that she didn't want to do anything herself to look bad in the eyes of law enforcement at that time, because she was trying to get her children back in the proper legal manner. So kidnapping your child wouldn't seem to be in her favor versus just being on your best behavior and regaining custody of both your children, not just one of them, the natural way. So since his disappearance over 10 years ago, so much has happened, but nothing has happened that's necessarily valuable to the case. Numerous family members have been accused of concealing Patrick, and honestly, I hope that's what the situation is, because all of these leads have been investigated and nothing has come of them. And I do want to touch on one more thing about, because, you know, to me, honestly, my theory is that Patrick ran away in that instance. Like, I feel like he probably ran away, and then I feel like something sinister did happen to him, because you have to remember, this is late January in Brooklyn. It is cold outside. It is not a warm time in Brooklyn. So I feel like, you know, even if he did run away, and let's just say something nature-wise happened to him, like he fell into a creek or he got lost in the woods, it was cold. They would have found his body, in my opinion. So I really do feel like something sinister happened after he ran away. But another horrific thing about this case is that Patrick Alford Sr., so Patrick's dad, was hanging up missing person flyers of his son when 5 men approached him, shooting him numerous times in the head. Now, somehow Patrick Sr. survived, which I'm shocked about because working in the ER, I see a lot of head gunshot wounds. And honestly, the chances of survival with even just a single gunshot wound, nonetheless multiple, sustaining any quality of life, or especially a non-vegetative state life, is fairly uncommon. But Patrick Sr. is still able to communicate. He survived, and he is now paralyzed from the incident, which is absolutely horrific, but he is still here. And I mean, this father is grieving his missing son, and these terrible people came along and stole something else away from him. So it's a truly, truly tragic situation, but Jennifer Rodriguez and Patrick Alford Sr. remain actively looking for their son, even 10 years later. They will never give up on searching for him, and they just pray that someday there will be answers to their question. Where in the world is Patrick Alford Jr.? Now, I will post pictures on the Instagram and Facebook feed, as well as an Age Progress picture, to see if any of you could possibly know the whereabouts of Patrick Alford Jr. This podcast has now gone across numerous countries, so you never know if Patrick's smile looks familiar to someone in a different region of the world. Regardless, his parents deserve answers on knowing where their son is and if he's dead or alive. Jennifer Rodriguez does believe that Patrick has passed on, but she's always keeping hope that he will return home someday. Although she thinks he's dead, Police have a different outlook, and this is a direct quote from a Reddit article which states, "Police still believe that Patrick is alive and in the area, and that family members could possibly be hiding him out. NYPD has reported to have interviewed close to 14,000 people and entered 9,000 apartments in their attempts to find Patrick, including those of registered sex offenders in the area he was last seen. A $12,000 reward is being offered in exchange for information on his whereabouts." And you guys, this quote was taken years ago, and the reward is actually now $250,000, with Crime Stoppers offering an additional $12,000 reward. So, a huge amount of money for any information on Patrick Alford. So, like I mentioned, if you know anything, even something that seems small but could offer investigators the slightest clue, please call authorities and give them your information. It's time we reunite Patrick with his sister, mother, and father, regardless of his fate. Someone out there has to know something. Even if Patrick was a runaway, this case does not make sense, so please, please come forward if you have any information. If you do have information, please contact the NYPD at 718-827-5331. That's 718-827-5331. Investigators will continue to search for Patrick, and they have no intentions on stopping their search until they find some answers on the whereabouts of Patrick Alford Jr. And like I said earlier, honestly, what I think that happened is that Patrick either ran away in that moment and was either abducted after running away, or that he like succumbed to hypothermia from the weather because it was the end of January in Brooklyn. So it gets freezing on that side of the country. But to me, that still, it just doesn't make sense, because how would no one have ever seen him if he ran away and died because of the weather? I mean, in my opinion, a little boy isn't going to go into the middle of the woods or somewhere where he could fall into a creek. Like, to me, that just doesn't make sense. I also wonder if Labrada wasn't paying nearly enough attention and was completely neglectful, and if he was abducted immediately after, like, right then and there when he was walking back to the apartment. Because if he did run away, wouldn't you, like, immediately get in your car and start looking for him? Like, so much doesn't make sense. To be honest, I'm just praying that his family has him and is hiding him. But at this point, he's 17 or 18, so it doesn't seem like you could really keep a now adult in secret. So the whereabouts of Patrick are honestly a huge, complete mystery. But Well, full-bodied family, that is the disappearance of Patrick Alford Jr., and I hope you enjoyed this case. And on Instagram, I'll tag the private investigator that reached out to me and that's involved in this case. So if you have any information, please feel free to DM him. Otherwise, don't forget to check in and follow our Instagram page at FB_crime podcast, our Twitter at FullBodiedCrime, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Full-Bodied Crime. Additionally, you can find all the sources for this case at full-bodiedcrime.com, and I would appreciate immensely any review from you guys on Apple, but you can catch us on wherever you stream your podcasts, and I will see you all very, very soon as I'm releasing another episode within this 24-hour time span. So it's actually 1 a.m. now in California. So I will see you all very, very soon. Buh-bye.